From high atop the Camelback Towers in Scottsdale, from the Star Worldwide Network Studios, this is Checking In with Check for a Lump. Arizona's prominent breast cancer nonprofit, providing free education, mammograms, wigs, and support. Now, let's check in with Check for a Lump.
Woohoo! Thank you so much for checking in with Check for a Lump today. I am Holly Rose, founder and CEO of Check for a Lump. I will be your host today, along with my co-host, Ashley Plum. How you doing, Ashley?
Doing great.
So happy you're here. And before we get started, I want to thank our wonderful annual sponsors, Cigna, Sonora Quest Laboratories, Pfizer, Arizona Center for Reconstructive Breast Surgery, Mint Cannabis, Harvest Trulieve, and Cancer Blood and Specialists of Arizona. We have got an exciting show for you today. We have the American Cancer Society game changer, Dr. Linda Greer from Arizona Diagnostic Radiology with us today. And along with her is their nurse navigator, Paula Miller. So we are so excited to have you here, ladies. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to dive right in and just tap into your education and expertise on mammography. And we would love to just start out with the guidelines. There's so much controversy over the guidelines.
Yeah, so every medical society that's actually involved with breast cancer, whether that be surgeons, oncologists, radiologists, OB-GYN, many more, I'm sure, we all very strongly agree that annual screening should start at 40. There is controversy about that, but it's generally among people that aren't directly involved with breast cancer screening. So every valid society seems to agree that 40 is the age to start screening for the average population.
And where did this discrepancy arise from?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of studies were used from around the world, and specifically there was one out of Canada that everybody referenced when specifically the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force was coming up with their guideline recommendations. They referenced a study from Canada that was done with really poor quality 2D mammography. They didn't control very well the study. So, for example, people that had a palpable lump already at the beginning of this study were put in the screening arm because they felt that those women should have a mammogram. So that already muddied the waters for the results because it wasn't really screening, it was diagnostic already. So more people in the screening arm would have cancer because right. they preferentially put the people with a palpable abnormality in that group from the start. So from the beginning, it was flawed. But then they didn't control that the people didn't intermingle within the groups. So a lot of the people in the screening arm were forever considered the screening arm, but they stopped screening. Or vice versa, people that were in the not screening arm started screening at some point, but they were still considered not screening. So anyway, that study had really flawed results, and that's been referenced quite a lot for no good reason. And they decided that the harms of mammography, which really the only harm that I can even think of and what they referenced, was that it's so stressful to get the callback letter. So about 10% of women, after they get a screening mammogram, will get called back in for additional views. Most of the time that gets resolved quite easily with the additional mammo views or ultrasound, and you're done. You're back to screening. But they think that that harm of the stress it causes to women, you know, can actually, you know, be more harmful than not screening. So that was sort of the argument. We obviously strongly disagree with that. You know, we feel very strongly that it's better to find your cancer early, so treatment is easier and shorter, and your survival rates are tremendously higher. So really, the argument just makes no sense to me. I don't feel that women become hysterical when they get the callback letter. Yeah, so it just makes no sense to me. The only goal in life for us is to find your cancer early and help you through the journey as fast and easily as possible. Paula, do you have anything to add?
No, I agree. Just so I can make it clear, I'm not a nurse, but I am a certified breast navigator. Done this a long time, and that's why we have navigation, because they come in for screening, Dr. Kerr finds something, and she thinks there needs to be a biopsy. We come together as a team to talk to them off a potential ledge, and like she said, more times than not, it's benign, or it turns out just to be, you know, normal breast tissue or whatever. But being able to jump in from the beginning, I think, is really something. Navigation isn't used a lot on the front end, particularly anymore, which I think is not fair to the patient. Because there, more times than not, there's really nothing to be afraid of, but to be able to have even a layperson just say, well, I believe in what the doctor's saying, or, hey, you know, let's calm down. I had a conversation with a physician recently, and I had to just encourage the physician, hey, let's not put the cart before the horse. This is a normal thing we need to do, and let's rule it out so you can see us next year, is really what it is.
Paula, you're a survivor yourself, aren't you?
I am. I was diagnosed at 35, but I had actually felt a lump for a few years before that. That's a whole different podcast.
Let me dive into that.
Well, you know, the screening kind of goes in with the should we or should we not do breast exams at home because it's too stressful. Really? Yeah, so I actually did the math this morning. If a physician saw 8 patients a day, or even 10 patients a day for a year, we're talking 2,500 breasts.
Yeah.
Before I had a mastectomy, they weren't that great. He wasn't going to remember my breasts, what they looked like, what they felt like. So it kind of falls into the same category of telling women that you'll be stressed out if you do this. Well, I'm more stressed out not getting, doing my own exams and then having to get an exam because maybe I didn't do it. You know what I mean? So, right. Yeah, well, it's very convoluted.
Yeah.
And the message of breast self-exam has gone away. And now you have to say breast awareness. I'm like, well, we're all aware of our breasts. That's silly. Check for a lump.
Right.
Check
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How do they look and feel? And are there any changes, right. Any abnormalities? And then if there are, of course, go in and see Dr. Greer.
100%. A few years ago, we did a study on women 45 and younger who were diagnosed with breast cancer. And I think it was close to 70% found their own changes.
Yeah, that's what we have found, too.
It's huge.
Mm-hmm. All of our clients who receive a wig. So, Dr. Greer, for the women who are afraid of getting a mammogram, whether it's, you know, just fear of finding something or fear it's going to hurt, what does the process look like for a woman to go in?
Well, we always try and talk them through the process. So it is their choice what they want to do. As long as they screen in some fashion, I'm usually okay with that. So people that are just terrified of mammograms themselves, you know, you can screen with ultrasound. And we just inform them that there's some things that might be missed, like little microcalcifications, which can be really the earliest sign of a cancer starting to grow. So, you know, as long as it's an informed decision on their part, I'm okay with them just screening with ultrasound because we will find the invasive cancers with ultrasound without a doubt.
That's great information for the women who are really fearful.
Yeah. I mean, you can screen with ultrasound. Just realize, you know, we're all smart, you know, make your own decision for your own life, but you might miss some of the earlier signs if you don't do a mammogram. But screening with ultrasound is pretty darn good. So, you know, that's okay. The other thing I tell them is many places around the valley have these comfort paddles now that are more curved. They're not just a flat paddle. And most people can have that. So it's supposed to conform to the shape of the breast better and be less painful. So then you just ask for the comfort paddle.
Very nice. And what about, I know that there's been advances and some imaging centers still have 2D mammography versus 3D. Can you share with women what that the difference is and what the radiologists are seeing, 2D versus 3D?
Yeah, so we got 3D mammography back in 2011, and it was a game changer. I'm saying that because I'm a game changer. It really changed the game. So what it is like taking slices through the breast as if like a CAT scan or reading a book, the pages of a book. We can see 1 millimeter slices through the breast. And so you no longer have the issue of your dense breast tissue is obscuring a mass or creating what appears to be a mass when it's just normal tissue. So it really changed how we practice, because now it was no longer, oh, we have to call you back for this little thing. Now I'm pretty confident when I call people back that, oh, I think it's going to be a cyst or I think this is bad. And you can streamline the workup down the line. So sometimes it's only an ultrasound instead of a lot of extra mammo views and a lot of extra, you know, cost really to the patient. We can just know confidently, yeah, this is going to be bad. So let's go ahead and do the ultrasound, check the lymph nodes. You know, we might even set them up for a biopsy potentials time slot, you know, so that we can get it all done. With 3D mammography, they found a 41% increase in invasive cancer detection, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's fewer callbacks, 15% reduction in callback. Yeah. It's a huge difference.
Game changer.
It is a game changer. Yeah. So people really should be asking for a 3D mammogram, and they're readily available around the country. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, ladies, I think we should take a quick little break here because we are going to rock out. We are so excited. This week we have the Blanks with us. So let's get ready and rock out. Blanks for sharing. You can find them on Spotify, The Blanks with a Z. Thank you for sharing with us. And let's tune back in. We have American Cancer Society game changer, Dr. Linda Greer and Paula Miller, both from Arizona Diagnostic Radiology with us today. So we're going to keep the conversation going. We're discussing mammography, and we've talked about the guidelines and fears, and I would love to talk about what happens if you do see something and what the next process looks like. What are the next steps for a woman?
So if you have a screening mammogram and there's an abnormality, then you get this letter saying, oh, we've seen something, you need to come back in for further imaging. At that point, they come back in. Usually we schedule it as a mammogram and ultrasound, but we might not do both. at that point, usually the radiologist will come in the room and talk to you, or sometimes if they're at a different location, which, for example, Casa Grande, I'll speak to them on the phone. And we discuss with them what we found and what needs to be done. Sometimes it's just a 6-month follow-up. Sometimes it's just normal. We'll see you next year. But if it is an abnormality that's of concern, we get them set up for a biopsy that day before they leave. And I may, if they're at my office, which is at the Park Central location, then Paula is right there. So I'll usually have them go chat with her for a little bit, and she'll calm them down, as she said. And then they return for the biopsy, and usually that is pretty casual. I've had a couple of ladies say, well, you're done already? Like, I didn't feel anything. So that's funny. So it's really not as scary as people anticipate that it will be. And we get the results the next day, and I call them on the phone. So Paula can probably add a little bit more to what happens in between. But
well done.
Thank you.
I love that. And I love that you have a navigator. I know that when I was diagnosed, the doctor essentially said, you have a long, hard road ahead of you. And they sent me out the door. And so I had no one to guide me. I had no idea what I was even going to do next. And so, Paula, what does how do you assist women?
So within about 20, well, within 24 hours of that biopsy, I'll call them just to check in. Of course, if it's a Friday, I call it Monday. I just do a quick check-in. How are you feeling? Is there anything odd, different? Did the bleeding stop? Usually there's little to none. You know, you always have that one person on blood thinners, and we could go down a rabbit hole. But and they're just kind of talking through it. How's it feel? Is there anything you want us to know about? Again, most people say it's great. If the pathology is in, the doctors will already know, and I can kind of hand off to the physicians. We really work closely with the referring physicians. Some of them like to, you know, they've been longtime doctors, and so we respect that and let them kind of do that. But anybody who's worked with Dr. Greer knows she's going to call you as soon as that pathology comes in. If it's benign, I might be able to have the pleasure of calling them, at least if it's on a Friday. But, you know, I think it's super important that the physicians are able to do that. And then, again, I get that handoff. Maybe it's a high risk. Maybe it's something that needs to be surgically removed, not tomorrow or next week, but should be done. And I can connect them with any of the local physicians that we directly work with, partner with, or sometimes they just say, I live in Apache Junction. Who's the closest person? And so we do a lot of that, too. And then I just continue to follow them, and just, you know, you become friends with your navigator after a certain point in time. And it's natural just to call them back in a week or two, make sure they got all their doctor's appointments set up. And usually they trickle on their way and, you know, check in occasionally. But yeah, so it's just being that third voice to kind of help them understand the processes, the collaborations, and the different you know, treatment plans and care plans that could apply to them specifically. And it could be anything. So, yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's very fulfilling. I love it.
Service. And I also love that, Dr. Greer, you call the women personally. That's beautiful. I don't think every doctor does that.
No, I don't think they do, but many do. And I do think it's really important because, you know, we're the ones that can explain, oh, this is what this means. And, you know, for example, it's a really low grade, slow growing tumor. I can really confidently tell them, you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, from day one, you are going to be fine. This is not going to be the thing that gets you. You know, you just have to get it removed. And I like to have that role of just being able to say, like, you know, it's okay, you know, and I think they need to hear that. And if it's more aggressive, then I'm, you know, pretty pushy. I'll say, you know, hey, let's get this done right away. And then Paula really jumps in and makes sure they get through the pathway pretty rapidly as much as possible and get the appropriate testing done.
So that's super interesting. Dr. Greer, I've been in the breast cancer world for 14 years now, and I didn't realize that you could tell the grade from the scan.
Yeah, from the original biopsy results. So it's from the pathology itself. The grade will come back. The stage is a different thing entirely. That's done surgically, where they determine the stage. But the grade of the tumor, how aggressive the tumor is, we know that from the first day.
Very beginning, yeah.
Can you explain for the women out there and or anybody who's listening the difference between stage and grade?
Yeah. So grade is pretty straightforward. It's either grade 1, 2, or 3. Grade 1 is very slow growing and a nice guy. And grade three is your ugly teenager brat that's going to try and destroy things. So intermediate grade is grade 2, kind of in between. Mm-hmm. So grade 3 is something that needs to be addressed quickly. Like perhaps I might send you straight to the oncologist too.
Okay.
Whereas grade 1, you probably don't need the oncologist the first step. You really need your breast surgeon the first step. So, we know that information already from day one. So it's nice to be able to tell them. Stage is something different. So that is, has it spread to your lymph nodes? Is there distant spread? Those things are handled in the follow-up. So the surgeon or the oncologist might order a PET scan or an MRI or something, blood work, whatever. If we biopsy a lymph node, we know a little piece of that, but for the most part, that's not determined the stage until after surgery.
Okay. So for those women who, like, for instance, myself, I was diagnosed with the stage and everything prior to starting all of my treatments, and I did surgery last, but I had the MRI. I had the mammogram, the ultrasound, the biopsy, the MRI, all of the things.
Yes.
and then I got my diagnosis. But they were able to tell that based on the MRI.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
All those different modalities, imaging, blood work, everything she said is unique to each and every individual case. So I should say it's just one more step so we can really see what we're looking at. Strangely enough, sometimes we look on an ultrasound and then you get an MR and it's slightly smaller. Size is relevant when it comes to cancer, but that does help encourage people to be like, okay, so it's not like what we thought. Mm-hmm. Or we thought it was in the lymph node,
But it's not.
So it's just there's so many variances to it. And so the ability to have so many different modalities or types of imaging to really tighten. So when we have someone and I'm like, okay, we're going to set you up with a surgeon, I already know this is going to be the medical oncologist, you will always consult. I don't care what stage.
Right.
You will always consult with a surgeon, a med onc, and a radiation oncologist. Like, that's just, you're just going to visit and say, hi, I like you, I don't like you, goodbye. Like, make it super simple. And I always lead with that, because if you don't, they're like, well, why do I need it? And it, and cancer care has come so far in a short amount of time. It's just easier to know what you're up against. So, like you, I did the gamut.
Yeah.
I think we pretty much knew. In fact, Dr. Greer diagnosed me. But and that was years ago. That was quite fun. But that's another podcast. But I walked out with the navigator that I was attached to, still friends with, who said, here's your surgeon, here's your oncologist, here's radiation, this is what you're doing next week, and just set everything up. And so that's really what I think a good navigation program should be based off of, and that's what I go off of, is here's everything you need to know that we know now, and the people who will give you the information that you need. Call me if you want to just talk through it.
Yes.
And go. And I think that's super important. I don't think it's common, but it's not as common.
Yeah.
And having navigation, I think, well, we know, just gets women in weeks, if not months more than some areas in the United States, because there's somebody assisting and directing.
Right. Helping them along
and
the way.
And doing that handoff. Mm-hmm. It's so important. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. The navigation is really, and it, I think it gives women comfort knowing there's somebody else there to help guide them along the way. That's not necessarily the doctor, I say in air quotes over here, you can't see, who might just look at the stuff and say, okay, this is what it is. You know, here's your next steps. But the navigator can say, you know, I'm here to help you throughout
and
the whole process.
And we connect with the families, the partners, the spouses, the children. Yeah. We're able to connect in a level that doctors just don't have time to do.
Exactly.
Well, and frankly, if we haven't gone through it ourselves, yeah. like, I don't know what the drains feel like, or I don't know. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that so I cannot tell
you.
We don't want you to be valid, in our club. Yeah. No offense, but we don't want you in our club.
But yeah, I think there's a beauty to having a navigator who's been through it and can really tell you this is what it's going to be like.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. Dr. Guerra, I'm curious as to the incidence of low-grade tumors versus aggressive tumors. Do you see a trend of more aggressive tumors?
Well, unfortunately, the trend that I am seeing is in younger people. So younger people have always tended to have more aggressive tumors. And whether that's a genetic link or just because they have more hormones on board or, you know, God knows what, bad luck. Younger women just traditionally tend to have more aggressive grade 3 tumors that are likely to spread. So,
And are you seeing more young women?
Yes. And I think the percentage is maybe a 2% increase per year that they're seeing or something. Oh, wow. It's a valid number. Yeah, it's a valid number. And so for
us, pretty large when you're talking the increased rate of cancer.
And those women aren't even of screening age, you know, and that's what is kind of scary for us to be arguing that we shouldn't be screening until later in life is just ignorant because younger and younger women are getting breast cancer, you know, the present company included. Right. So I just feel that it's a hide your head in the sand thing. The younger women have more years to live. They have younger children. They have, you know, they're busy at work. There's a lot of things about a 35-year-old that's vastly different than an 85-year-old. 85-year-olds tend to have very low-grade, slow-growing tumors. Treatment is minimal. You know, it's pretty easy to deal with. So I would advocate that we even push screening further younger, like they did with colon cancer. Right. We should be screening younger women. But nobody yet has come up with that recommendation.
Well, and they always focus it towards that high risk potential, right? Is it genetic? Genetics is a huge, quote, new thing in the recent, since we've all been diagnosed, where they're pushing and advocating for it more. But then again, it's, okay, we take your family history. Oh, you're high risk. Here's a letter. Go home. And it's like, and that's also the other half of navigation is calling and saying, okay, what does that really mean? The dense breast issue, what does that really mean? And then being able to really advocate for those young women to get them seen by somebody.
Can you share with our listeners what that does mean, having dense breasts?
Yeah, so breast density is just determined by how much fibroglandular tissue or breast tissue is in there versus fat. So there's a spectrum, and it's kind of artificially designated that if you're 50% or less of dense breast tissue, which looks white on a mammogram, you're considered in the fat category. And then if it's 50% or greater of this denser fibroglandular tissue, then you're considered in the dense category. That's a very artificial statement, but that's how we do it. Because the risk of somebody who's 51% dense is vastly less than somebody that's 90% dense. And we don't, in the current guidelines, separate between you two. So when I talk to people, I try and tell them, well, you know, you're just really on the borderline of being dense, you know, so not much to worry about, but we are recommending perhaps adding an ultrasound in your screening regimen. People that are super dense, we might even say you should probably get a breast MRI as well. Breast MRI, the way it functions is independent of your density because we subtract pre and post contrast images. So it doesn't care how dense you are. I think it's important that women know that too. And like I said, it's very arbitrary. You could be just very minimally dense, but you still fall in the dense category. So it is worth a conversation.
Yeah.
So your density change over time?
Yeah, so as we get older, we tend to get less dense because we get more fat. And as that fibroglandular tissue sort of atrophies as we get older, you become less dense. So that's the generalization, but a lot of people pretty much stay dense their whole lives, especially if you're really thin.
as you get older, then when do you recommend women stop receiving mammography screening?
The guidelines are crazy for this, and they vary across the board with how they phrase it. So some say, you know, when you have 10 years left to live, you should stop. Well, how do you know that? You know, that's a crazy statement. So I think that's the American College of Radiology says that, by the way. So that's sorry for that, guys. I believe that it should be.
I told my husband that we're both going to die at 85 at the same time. So I guess I'm going to stop when I'm 75.
That's a hard no.
No.
No, it should be when you cannot tolerate any treatment at all, then you should stop. So, you know, for why find out if you can't do anything about it? But most people can tolerate, you know, an mm-hmm. anti-estrogen pill mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. minimal surgery. Or, you know, if you can tolerate anything, you should keep screening. There's very, very healthy 90-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And right. then there's really, really unhealthy 60-year-olds.
Exactly.
So, 40-year-olds. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think it's just based on if you could tolerate something, you should screen.
Yeah. For sure.
What is the youngest age that you've diagnosed?
Oh, gosh. Me personally, probably late 30s, but I've heard of 27-year-olds.
Oh, no, we've diagnosed 26, 23, yeah. 24. And then when I was in gynecology, oncology, we had a 16-year-old. So
we had a friend who was diagnosed at 12.
Wow. Yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Before we go, we always love to do a check for a lump quiz.
This week's trivia. How many women, on average, will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime, or each year, actually?
Is that directed to us? Oh, yeah.
You okay. can answer it.
One in eight.
That is right. It is one in eight women.
Ladies, I have so many more questions to answer or to ask you. Would you mind coming back next week so we can continue this conversation?
That'd be great.
We'd love to.
Oh, that's wonderful. So thank you, Dr. Greer, Paula Miller, for checking in with Check for a Lump. I want to thank our sponsors, Cigna, Sonora Quest Laboratories, Pfizer, Arizona Center for Reconstructive Breast Surgery, The Mint Cannabis, Harvest Trulieve, and Cancer Blood and Specialists of Arizona. Thank you so much for checking in with Check for a Lump, and we will continue this conversation next week.